This is Freedom First, and I'm Jeffrey Tucker. I would like to talk to you today about transportation in America. Have you taken a plane recently? Chances are that your flight was delayed or rescheduled, and you found yourself frustrated not knowing what was what. There's always some reason. I was on a plane recently, and the airbags had fallen out from the airplane. The oxygen masks all over the plane, and they didn't know why. They had to fix that. They had to bring a mechanic in. That delayed the thing like 5 hours. And then we finally got on the plane, started to take off. We started taxiing down the runway, about to go up in the air. And the light came on that the emergency door wasn't working, so we had to go back to the airport, and they had to call another mechanic, and that delayed and delayed and delayed. The delay ended up being 18 hours. They stuck us in a hotel with some food coupons. I don't want to just spend all this time complaining, but it just happens more than you really want. I mean, it just seems like these days you can't really rely on the airplanes anymore, and the security systems are annoying, and they're doing retina scans of you, and so many checks, and the lines are long, and it's just a miserable and exhausting experience. On the other hand, the option is, for most Americans, to drive somewhere. And we know what that involves. That involves worrying about mechanical problems and having to trust other drivers are not drunk or stoned, and you're hurling down the roads at 60, 70, 80, 90 miles an hour. Anybody can go anywhere. There's always some one crazy person endangering everybody's lives. And then you get a notification that there's a crash ahead, and then everybody has to look at it, and you see some big twisted pile of metal, and the car is smoking, and the ambulance is there dragging bodies around. You've seen them, and it's just terrible. It's miserable, and you think, but for the grace of God, there go I. It's really scary and super stressful. Then you add to that the darkness. You know, driving in the dark is really hard, relying on nothing but your headlights and streetlights, if you're lucky. And then you add rain and weather, say nothing of snow and hail, and things get extremely dangerous. It's just a stressful and dangerous experience. And you never know what's going to happen. If you happen to break down, you have to call AAA. You don't know when they're going to get there. They may or may not be able to fix it, so they have to call a tow truck. And you find yourself in some strange town paying goodness knows how much for repairs. So it's so awful. It's really awful. Driving is a terrible experience these days. I'm going to get to why this matters, but I want to first back up and do a foray into the industry called the train, the railroad system. Now, you'd think that at my age, I would have been driving trains all my life, but in fact, most Americans have never even been on a train. The first train I rode, really, I think, was just 5 years ago. I got an Amtrak to go from Western Massachusetts down to New York and back again. I couldn't believe it. I simply couldn't believe it. I arrived 45 minutes early, which I thought I was going to be late. Well, I sat around for 45 minutes. It turns out with trains, and if you know this, you know this. But if you don't know this, this would be very interesting to you. You could show up 5 minutes, 2 minutes before the train leaves, which people do. Just hop on the train. You just hop on. There's no security checks. You're not having to do, you know, multiple ID systems or scanning systems. You just walk in with your bags, get on the train, sit there, find your place, relax, enjoy yourself, and then somebody comes through and checks your ticket. And that's it. They just scan your ticket and hi, and that's it. Then the train stops, you get off, and you're to your destination. While you're on the train, you get a beautiful view out the window. It's steady, so it looks like a movie going by. It's just a steady roll. No fast turns and stops and having to change lanes, put on your blinker or anything. No, you're just in a nice chair and you're driving along. And there's high-speed internet on the train too, so you can get all your work done. So it's just like sitting at home or being at your desk in the office and working. It's so luxurious and so exciting. I mean, it just makes my heart pump with joy for being on a train. And I get why they're so popular, at least in the old days in America. And again, I'm going to get to that in a second. But just a quick story. Most Americans have never been on a train because passenger trains are not available in most parts of the country. In the Northeast Corridor, they're, I guess, fairly common. There's commuter rails all over going to and from New York, Boston, and to some extent D.C., but that's the only part of the country where they're really used. In most parts of the South and the West, it's not really a thing. Trains are just not really used. Now, I have a friend who just took off for a tour of Europe. And he went to Barcelona. And then he went to Amsterdam and then Berlin. And then Prague and Budapest. And he's going to Rome. And he's just going everywhere and doing whatever he wants. He also went to Paris. Considered London, but because there's a railroad there, too, but decided against that. But it's just having a grand time using the Eurorail pass. And he gets on these trains, and whereas the U.S. Amtrak has a snack bar, which is, I've always been grateful for that, you can get some chips and nuts and maybe a microwave hamburger, the trains in Europe have full restaurants with menus, with a kitchen, with a wait staff. Plus bars where you can stand, you can sit, you can socialize, have fun, order drinks, there's cocktails, there's bartenders. It's crazy. And if you want to sleep, you can do that too. So you can take off at 10 p.m., sleep on the train, and arrive at 6 a.m. in a completely different country in another part of Europe. How wonderful, how luxurious, and completely affordable with a Eurorail pass. And this is very common, at least in the old days. Americans used to go to Europe on a Euro pass and stay in hostels and have a glorious adventure vacation, going to museums and cathedrals and castles and seeing the countryside and on nature walks and everything else with a backpack, hostels, and the Eurorail pass. Now, if you live in Europe, it's funny to have to point this stuff out, but this is the reason the cars are small. They're used for urban commutes and for going to the suburbs, to the train stations or whatever. They're not like American cars, which are gigantic and big, and at least in the old days, designed to carry you long distances. In Europe, most people use the cars just to get to train stations, and that's it. That's what the roads are for, too. So that's the reason for the difference. But trains are extremely well-developed in Europe. It's like a different world, and the security situation is the same. You arrive 5 minutes before the train goes. You hop on the train. You show them your pass, and it's like, welcome, and you get to your new town and hop off the train. You can grab an Uber to where you want to go, and that's it. That's the way Europe works now. So it's strange, because if you've ever done anything like this, you just have to ask the question, what went wrong in this country that we're in such a strange situation today? So let's just go back in history a little bit. In the 19th century, the U.S. led the world in railroad construction and train technology. It was the great booming industry of the 19th century. Between 1830 and 1860, American industry laid 30,000 miles of tracks, eventually creating a railroad system that connected both coasts together. And it was, after the Civil War, was the industry. Many of them were public-private partnerships. A lot of them were private, and they competed with each other, and they built railroad stations. And a lot of the banking controversy of the late 19th century centered on where the railroads were going to be built. And so you get these rumors flying through town, we're going to get a railroad, we're going to get a railroad station here. And then land speculators would start bidding up the prices, and then the banks would provide liquidity for all the new loans, and then the rumor turned out to be false, and the bank would go belly up, and this was called wildcat banking. That's presumably what the Fed was trying to get rid of, but that was the reason for it. It was the railroad industry. But it was a classic American industry, driven by free enterprise and private investment, and it was the envy of the world, the American train system. I always think about one entrepreneur in particular, James J. Hill, ran an entirely private railroad, was always being hauled in before Congress to testify on prices of tickets, and he was a huge advocate of private enterprise, hated government intervention, thought that private enterprise, you know, could build all the infrastructure a nation needed. There are many people who felt this way. And it was a very beautiful system. James J. Hill, by the way, became the subject of a novel that I think was published in 1922 by Garrett Garrett called The Driver, which is a great book. I urge you to read it, which itself became the template of what was one of the best-selling books of the 20th century called Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand that focused very heavily on the train industry because railroads and trains were the great classic American industry. It was the thing that America did really well. Well, times changed. The car industry began to grow and grow with Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, many companies making cars, and it became more politically powerful and influential than the old railroad companies by the middle of the 20th century. So after World War II, Dwight D. Eisenhower embarked upon some grand program, a grand central plan in the fashion of the Soviets, really, and the Nazis, and decided to start an interstate highway system. And the idea was to build a highway system that connected the whole country. The main driving force of this was military considerations, because we were now in a Cold War. After World War II, the U.S. got very concerned about the influence of the Soviets in European politics, and the U.S. was in possession of nuclear weapons, the only country that ever used them, and thought we were entering into a nuclear age and an armed struggle with Russia. So the interstate highway system was constructed around this military priority. The idea was to build large-scale highways all over the country that would transport nuclear weapons around, somehow evading detection by the Russians, true story, and then also making evacuation from cities, presumably bombed by nuclear weapons, more easily in case there was a bomb coming. It's a strange plan because if you've ever been on a highway in a rush out of the city during an evacuation, you know that everything's at a standstill. It doesn't actually work. But nonetheless, the interstate highway system was constructed. Starting in 1956, it lasted for 10 years, 20 years, in some sense, it's still being built today. As part of this, there was a massive, gigantic, hardly commented upon redistribution of wealth away from small towns that had thrived with railroad stations and a network of roads that were extending out of them to completely replace this organic system of transportation that had developed over a century and a half with some brand new scheme where these highways were built everywhere without any regard whatsoever for the organic patterns of demographics and town wealth, mostly in response to, you guessed it, political lobbying. If you lobbied hard enough and you were powerful enough, then you got your highway. And around the new interstate highway system, it obviously drained wealth away from the small towns that had thrived with railroads and their network of roads that had already connected the country. Yeah, not in gigantic interstates, but in beautiful roads that were towns and county roads all over the country that put on display the greatness and beauty of this country, and replaced them with these gigantic, you know, central planning style roads that had no regard for the history or demographics of the country. And they connected the whole country. And this was also a period where the American franchises were becoming very popular. So instead of looking at charming towns through your railroads and then getting in your car, being picked up by the family or whatever, and or being able to get in the family car and drive from, you know, circuitous directions all over the country and seeing the real country, you get on the interstates now and you see the same thing, basically forever from one end of the country to the other, up and down. And it's just signs for fast food restaurants, it's Chick-fil-A, it's McDonald's, it's Wendy's, it's this, and gas stations. And that's it. That's what you see in America today, thanks to the interstate highway system. Trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars spent on this new highway system that ended up destroying countless small towns. I mean, how many times has this happened to you where you go to an old town and think, well, this place is kind of nice. Why is this 12-story hotel? downtown that nobody seems to occupy. It seems kind of decrepit and not really used. Oh, well, that was the hotel that everybody stayed in because the railroad came here. Oh, really? Where's the railroad station? Oh, that's, you know, here's the railroad tracks, now used just for freight, if used at all. And there's the old train station that's not used at all. And now it's an art gallery or a brewery or a diner. This is true for thousands of towns across this country, tens of thousands of towns. They're corpses of what they were. The industries that built up around them, the housing structures, all gone and decrepit. It was just a devastating decision on the part of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who otherwise wasn't a bad president, but why he did this? It was entirely driven by war and military considerations. And it fundamentally changed this country. But as part of this, of course, we neglected our trains, which was the thing that we did really, really, really well in the 19th century, all the way up the Great War, and the Depression set it back. But we had a wonderful system of trains and small towns and roads in this country, ruined completely by the interstate highway system. Now, the line was that driving is more consistent with the American ideals of independence and freedom. So you can just get in your car and just drive and drive. And okay, that sounds good, and American cars were great. But along with that comes other things you don't really want. The fear of accidents, the having to trust that everybody is sober when they're out driving, the volition of other drivers. You can't always trust that the community is going to be perfectly intact. I know that some parts of the country have extremely rude drivers that scare the heck out of you, like Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey. It's terrifying to drive in those states. In other places, everything's better. Like Texas has a great, I would say, culture of driving. But still, you have to worry about the weather, about the cars breaking down, about potholes in the road. It's just stressful to drive. And if you've ever taken a train from one place to the other, you know it just doesn't compare. Driving's stressful and scary, and it exhausts you. And you can't get any work done because you constantly have to turn corners and change lanes and stop and start all the time. And you certainly can't use your internet while driving. Whereas a train, you're sitting in a beautiful chair, working, looking at the beautiful scenery, and having the time of your life. It's just an incomparable experience, so superior. And yet this country, due to Cold War priorities, chose cars over trains. As a result, we've got train stations all over the country still in the process of closing. You know, even now, train stations are closing. Beautiful, once beautiful constructions all over the country are now just either closed or closing, decrepit, falling apart. You know, it's amazing to think that this ever happened. Revisiting this history is a very strange experience, because you think the interstate highway system might have seemed like a grand national project to unite the country, but actually it ruined so much of America and caused us to neglect our train industry, which we had led for the whole world only 50 years earlier. And here we are now in the 21st century, a quarter of the way through it, and our trains only function in a small area of the country, and otherwise we're all stuck in cars. Scary cars, or going on planes where half the time the plane is late and it's a miserable experience due to the security situations. You get crammed into these planes like sardine, and it's miserable and it's very, very expensive. So we've got a transportation problem in this country, a terrible transportation problem. And I just maintain that this problem is of our own creation. It's because of the decisions that governments make. Meanwhile, in major other parts of the civilized world, there's beautiful train systems that are connecting everybody. It's very, very sad, this one decision to construct an interstate highway system. Okay, but there's a coda to this. Now we've got the Green New Deal and the Biden administration that loves it. And you know what that is. It means down with oil and gas, down with internal combustion, up with wind power, and solar, systems and solar panels, and this is where we're going to make our energy in the future. And now everybody has to buy EVs because that's consistent with reducing CO2 emissions. That's the idea. Okay, never mind that most electricity in this country is provided by coal, which itself is what they call a fossil fuel. And they're going to reveal this to us, I would say, in about 5 years. Oh, we can't make any more of this stuff. Coal's bad. You're using too much electricity. Well, the EVs are just, you know, they're fine as a second car for urban commuters, but for most of the country, they don't work. That's why the coasts are the only place where people are really buying these things. There's every bit of evidence that demand for these EVs is peaked. They lose half their mileage in cold weather. A lot of times you drive to the charging stations and they don't really work. You can't go on long trips with them unless you want to spend most of your time diverting your travel and spending hours staying in charging lines and then charging up. And they don't work in the cold. And if you have to do repairs, forget it, right? I mean, there's most mechanics cannot work on these things, so you have to take them back to the dealer. And the expense, if you've ever had to replace an air conditioner on a hybrid car or an EV, you'll just be shocked at the prices. And I'm telling you, getting a new battery for an EV is way more expensive than getting a new transmission for an internal combustion car. So there's a reason that demand has peaked, but that's not deterring the Biden administration. They're determined to get us all in EVs. They have mandates on all the manufacturers that certain number of cars that they make have to be EVs, even if there's no demand for them. Even though rental car places are turning them in, there's every bit of evidence that the demand has peaked, they still have to make them to comply with the Biden administration's central plan. So it's yet another example. But this example is a strange one. Because after having thrown all of our national resources into away from trains and towards cars, now we're going the opposite direction and say, oh, you can't drive in cars either. We had great internal combustion cars, but now you can't use them anymore. If you're going to get a new car, you have to be an EV. Okay. So, but those are perfect for 15-minute cities, but they're not great for cross-country travel. So we're going to be using the interstates ever less and less with the EVs, if these plans turn out. So now you can't fly because that's expensive and inconvenient and unreliable. There's no trains anymore because we drove all those out of business, at least for passenger purposes, and only used for freight purposes. And now we're going to be stuck in electric vehicles that are not good for family trips or going any kind of distance over a place like Texas, for example, or say nothing in the West. They're only good for urban commutes and mostly in warm weather climates, and even then only as second cars for homeowners with charging stations that are domestic. That's our situation. It's like one bad decision after another. And it's tragic. We've done violence to our transportation systems. Over the course of the last 75 years, essentially, is how this has happened. I'm not even proposing in particular anything we can do about this, except for definitely the Biden administration needs to leave the auto industry alone. Let people have their internal combustion cars. Let oil and gas industry function as it should, and stop this weird prioritization of the Green New Deal instead of internal combustion and traditional energy sources. That'd be one good thing. But the idea of building a high-speed train system in this country because we regret what we did in 1956 with the interstate highway system, I don't think that would be a good idea either. I mean, if you could just in a blink of an eye push a button and make it happen, that'd be one thing. But of course, that's not going to happen. And I'm worried about suggesting any other government programs to fix this. So I'm telling a story about a real tragedy here, it seems to me, that is not talked about enough. And it has to do with government deciding through its central plan, through its intellectuals and its use of resources, to pick winners and losers in the industrial structure. That has created nothing but chaos for us. A better way is just simply to put freedom first. This is Jeffrey Tucker.